Here comes the boss. Well, as our monthly meeting this month, we are pleasured to have with us Fred Johnson. Okay, this is our monthly society meeting. It's our pleasure to have Fred Johnson from the Brimfield Bank with us, who is the president of the bank, and we'll let him tell us a little story about the past history as well as up to the future. And he's got some real future message. Says he's going to open tomorrow.
Thanks very much.
Now let's see, we go through all, we're all set to go. All right, let me tell you that I'm very pleased to be here. And I must say that when Eddie asked me to do this, I had some qualms about my credibility, because I know that there are people in this room who would give meaning to the 57th verse of the 13th chapter of Matthew, where it says a prophet is not without honor save in his own country and his own house. Now, this isn't my country or my house, but this is my hometown, and I'm sure some of you remember the days I was breaking windows and upsetting things. And so I hope that won't destroy my credibility. But the assignment that Eddie gave me and what I'm here to do is to discuss with you a little bit and give you a summary of the history of the former Exchange State Bank, now Brimfield Bank, of which I am the current president. And before we get into that bank, I, with a bow toward the official village historian, let me say that this bank, which was formed in 1913, was not the first banking business in the village. As early as 1875, a man by the name of C.T. Held, H-E-A-L-D, conducted a banking business, and this, it must have been good, because just 2 years later, a man by the name of C.W. Hamilton went into the banking business, and shades of the current regulations, which allow banks to do all sorts of things, compete with insurance agents and everything else. Henrietta mentioned to me today that Hamilton even sold ocean tickets, or voyage, tickets for voyages on the ocean. So he must have been quite a banker. For your next trip on the Cunard Line, don't come to the Brimfield Bank. We don't have them. But to the subject of at hand, specifically the local bank, first thing of any significance that occurred was 4 days before Christmas in 1921, when at the application of three local citizens, whose names are familiar to all of us who've been around here any length of time, namely Charles L. Dungan, Henry A. Blundy, and Horace Cady, they applied for a permit to organize a banking business with the Office of the Auditor of Public Accounts in Springfield. And I must say that as I look over that document and the paperwork that was involved with it, I'm struck with how similar it was in 1912 and 13 with what it is today. I've been involved in the incorporation of a couple of state banks recently, and it's just the way we do it today. You first ask for a permit to organize and give a little idea of what you expect to do, and then the Auditor of Public Accounts issues the permit, and then you go ahead and sell your shares, get subscribers to the stock, and commence business once they actually issue the charter. This is a preliminary step. Well, that charter was issued on the 16th of January in 1913. That's the date that the present bank's charter was issued by the state of Illinois. And it authorized those three incorporators to commence the business as a bank. That charter was recorded that same afternoon at 2:15 in the county recorder's office, filing fee 75 cents. So you can start a bank for less than a buck, or you could then. Well, the original stock issue there was 500 shares, which were sold at $100 a share, thus producing $50,000 in capital. Now, ordinarily, when a bank is commenced, the subscriptions are collected, and the accountant tells you what to do with that amount of money that's raised. It was not the case with the Exchange State Bank, because they acquired another banking business, which was then in operation. This must have been the third one. And C.L. Dungan and Company were operating a bank under the name of Exchange Bank, not Exchange State Bank, and Mr. Dungan was one of the incorporators and one of the original subscribers, matter of fact, the largest shareholder in the bank when the shares were, or when the charter was actually issued. And they apparently, by prior arrangement, the Exchange State Bank of Brimfield, which was its official name, acquired the assets and resources of the Exchange Bank operated by C.L. Dungan and Son. Now, that what the under what authority the Dungan operation was conducted, I don't know, but I'm going to stick with Exchange State Bank. So they sold out the original 500 shares, and let me read you the name of the original shareholders. Not a very long list, but it's some very familiar names to those of us who've been around here a long time, and unhappily that includes me now. Charles L. Dungan, Joseph W. Dungan, Carrie M. Dungan, Henry A. Blundy, Charles C. Carson, first cashier, Lewis Tate, I believe he was a doctor, Dr. Tate, James King, I know nothing about him, Horace Cady, H.J. Memler, that would be Herman Memler, and his brother Henry Memler, Thomas A. Day, William W. Harding, that was probably, was that the father of Bill, the longtime mayor, Charles W. Wynn, Richard Pacey, and an A. Manville, I don't know who that was, but so those were the first subscribers to the stock of the bank. Among them, they owned 500 shares. That very night of the 16th of January, in 1913, they held their first meeting of the shareholders with 490 of the 500 shares present in person or by proxy, and they conducted the organizational meeting of the bank. That time, they fixed the number of directors at 5, which is still the case. And they elected the first board of directors, which consisted of Mr. Dungan's, Charles L. Dungan, Henry Blundy, Horace Cady, Charles Wynn, and Charles Carson. Then once they were elected, those directors elected the following officers: the president, surprise, surprise, C.L. Dungan; the vice president, Horace Cady; the cashier, Charlie Carson. President's salary for that first year, $1,200 a year. Same today, more or less. Cashier's salary, $1,500 a year. So now the bank is formed and ready to roll. So they had shortly thereafter, they had a special meeting, and this to me is very interesting, during which meeting the newly formed bank, and I'm quoting now, took over the business and property of the Exchange Bank owned by Charles L. Dungan and Company, according to a schedule which Mr. Dungan submitted. And what the Exchange State Bank took over was as follows: deposits of $215,000, overdrafts of $12,058, bills receivable of $125,000, a credit in the First National Bank of Chicago of $10,008, a credit in the Livestock Exchange National Bank of Chicago of $1,500, a credit in the Merchants National Bank of Peoria, which was the predecessor of the Commercial National Bank, now First of America, of $55,004, cash on hand of $77,073, and bonds in the amount of $3,000. So that's what the Exchange State Bank took over and accepted, as the minutes said. And in further consideration of the turning over of all the property, the banking house, the fixtures, and other valuable considerations, they paid Charles L. Dungan and Company for the business, property, and goodwill of Exchange Bank, $15,000. Of course, you've got to remember that the deposits of a bank are, it's great to have $215,000, but for a bank, that's a liability. Those deposits, of course, belong to somebody else. So $15,000 was probably not a bad price. And Mr. Dungan guaranteed all bills receivable and the overdrafts. I know you were worried about those. $12,000 in overdrafts is quite a sum for the bank of that size. So that's how the thing got rolling to start with in 1913, just prior to the First World War. And the thing went along rather uneventfully through the balance of the teens and through the 20s till we got near the end of the 20s. And while I can't specifically remember, having been born in 1927, we all know that in 1929 there was a stock market crash, and the depression really got rolling about that time. And that had an adverse effect on the bank. Without being specific about it, there some troubled times began about that time, and in 1931, on November 5th, the Auditor of Public Accounts closed the bank for 5 months. And at that time, he required the shareholders, the people who had the 500 shares, to surrender their entire stock holdings. And now I'm quoting from the subscription agreement which followed. They were surrendered for the purpose of permitting the said stock to be sold to such persons as may care to subscribe for the same and are interested in the continuance of banking accommodations in the village of Brimfield. So on November 5th, 1931, in my file I've got the original document. It's kind of interesting to look at. It's a little tattered now. A subscription agreement was signed by a number of people, which recited the following, and this shed some real light on it. Whereas the sum of $50,000 must be paid in on the stock of said bank in cash to meet the requirements of the auditor for said bank to reopen. So it was in fact closed, and apparently for about 5 months. Now therefore, in consideration of the reestablishment of banking facilities, the undersigned hereby subscribe, and so on. And that subscription list is a... Ed, hand me that. I want to read you some of these names because they're familiar to most of us. This isn't all of the people that subscribe, but it's a kind of a laundry list of old Brimfield people. Lon Arnold headed the list, 2 shares. John Zern, Sam Nykirk, Robert F. Tucker, Dr. Nolding, Mildred Pacey, Dr. Roberts, Earl Maher, G.R. Claypool, R.D. Savage, John Fox, Homer Tucker, Dr. J.E. Welch, Henry Reinhardt, all these names familiar to me in my youth, of course, Charles Ekenaw, Jackson Reed, Fred Sloan, Earl Overham, Bert Klusky, and here's a name dear to my heart in his own hand, Fred Arbor, Mildred Littlefield, Fred Wallacker, Ethel A. Memmer, C.L. McDonough, Clinton Day, M.R. Clark, John Finnegan, Rudy Berniga, H.R. Johnson & Son, that's in my dad's hand, out the side indicating that Henry Johnson and Dean H. were both going to take 1 share. Why didn't they glom onto more of that? Poor God, it's expensive. Well, you get the flavor of what I'm trying to... Henry Arnold, Leonard Porter, C.M. Travis and Herman Griggs, Griggs and Travis right there together, Warren Ayers, Cliff Lundy. So you get the idea. In other words, the auditor was wanting the stock to be redistributed, and the townsmen, being interested in the banking business continuing, were given the opportunity to subscribe to it, and they did. Now, they didn't subscribe to all 500 shares. And I can only assume, without knowing for certain, that what wasn't subscribed was again picked up by the Dungan and Lundy families. Well, the stock record book, which is right there on that table, indicates that on April 2nd, 1932, you see, 5 months after the date of the subscription agreement, there were 352 shares issued to 106 people. So the remaining 148 shares, since there were still 500 outstanding, must have been picked up by the Dungan and Blundy interests, although that isn't particularly, or isn't absolutely certain. So the bank was permitted to reopen, and has, of course, been open ever since, except for the maybe a couple of days when FDR closed all the banks the following year, in 1933. That was in March of 1933. I was initially confused in my own mind because I thought perhaps the period that this bank was closed was coterminous with when Roosevelt closed all the banks. Not so. So the bank weathered the storm and launched into the 30s. And next, I want to discuss the period which extends from the early 30s through the 1950s. The Dungan and Blundy families were the holders of the controlling stock in the bank during all this period, although M.R. Clark was able to acquire, and did acquire, in excess of 100 shares. I think the maximum he held was 123 during this period, which made him the largest single shareholder in the bank. But the combination of the Dungan and Blundy interests were sufficient to control the bank. In other words, they amounted to more than 250 shares. Bank all through this period was run conservatively and well. The primary cashiers during the latter part of the period, at least, being Charlie Clinch from Elmwood and W.P. Starr from Galesburg. Strikes me as odd that both the chief operating officers during that period, of course, Charles Carson was also the cashier for a long time, and I believe Ted Dungan, C.F. Dungan, followed him, and then came Clinch and Mr. Starr. But it always strikes me as a little odd that they were from out of town. We always hear in Peoria all the time, why don't we hire local people? And of course, there's a lot of merit. I don't want to speculate on why that was. Those were both capable people, and they ran a fine bank. Now, all through this period, up through the 50s, there was not a period of particularly significant growth for the bank. But they followed sound practices, and the interests of the community, I think, were well served. Now, during 1961, a very significant event occurred in that, for the first time in the bank's history, the controlling interest was sold by the Dungan and Blundy families to a non-Brimfield person. And this man was really a non-Brimfield type. His name was Leland Norris, and he was a young lawyer from Kansas City. I wish I hadn't mentioned he was a lawyer. But we're trying to be factual here. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about Mr. Norris's term as president of the bank, but I'm sure it's non-slanderous and accurate to indicate to you that Mr. Norris never did have the best interests of the bank or the community at heart. And I want to stress that at the time that he acquired the controlling interest in the bank, but unbeknownst to the sellers, the selling local people had no idea that this was the case. He owned the controlling interest of a small bank in Strong City, Kansas. And at that time, that bank was on the federal regulators' watch list. In other words, there was some funny stuff going on in Kansas, and they were watching him like a hawk. Well, he soon installed a cashier from Missouri. I would say imported a cashier from Missouri. Maybe some of you remember him. His name was Tom Johnson. Lawyers and Johnsons, I don't know. No relation. And Mr. Norris set about engaging in some very unsound banking practices. Now, about that time, my late brother and I considered it would be a wise thing if we accepted Mr. Norris's invitation to serve on the bank's board of directors. And we did that for two principal reasons. One, a community interest, and another, a self-interest. The former, of course, we wanted to be in a good position to ascertain the motives of the new buyer and to monitor his banking activity so as to be in a position to ensure, to the extent we were able, that the Brimfield community would continue to be well served by the bank. Now, at that time, the bank's bylaws and charters, or not the charter, the bylaws, still provided for five directors, but there are only three, Norris, Arbor, and myself. We just never filled the vacancies. So we were in a pretty good position, two out of three, to control his activities. And the second reason, as I had mentioned, the self-interest, we wanted to be in a position to acquire the controlling stock of the bank should it ever become available. In other words, if he, for one reason or another, either wanted to or had to sell it, we wanted to be there to buy it. Well, we got a lot of assistance from the fellow by the name of Wilkins, D.E. Wilkins, was the supervising examiner of the Federal Deposit Insurance Office in Chicago. And he was the one that was watching the strong Citibank and was most anxious for Mr. Norris to move on to other endeavors. And Arbor and I had a great trip up to Chicago on the 30th of November of 1962. At that point, Mr. Norris had already sold the bank to a Chicago lawyer by the name of Edgar Blumenfeld. And Mr. Blumenfeld was sprinkling notices of special meetings all over town here, a special meeting of the shareholders where they were going to reorganize the thing and more to their liking. So I thought, being a younger lawyer than my brother, that it was a vain and useless thing to go to Chicago with a sack full of money, because he'd already sold it to somebody else, and as a matter of fact, taken a down payment. About $8,000, I recall. But we met him in the lobby of the Chatham National Bank on the south side of the city of Chicago. And friends, I want to tell you, I was scared to death to be there. We stood at the customer counter in this bank. We were to meet him at 3 o'clock. I'm telling you more than you need to know here, but to me, this is really interesting, and I hope you agree. Anyway, we stood at this counter, and Norris didn't show up. Now, he had gotten his loan to buy the bank from that bank, the Chatham Bank, and of course it was delinquent. And this Wilkins, the supervising examiner, was interested that that loan be paid. The Chatham Bank was under the gun. And so Wilkins was really on our team. Boy, he wanted us to leave town with that stock. So I called him from the bank, and I had to stand there with this yellow pad, no agreement, nothing. And I said, well, we're here to meet Norris. We had this agreement to meet him. And he said, well, he's up in the office of a fellow named Ken Katsky, who ran the Chatham Bank, later was imprisoned, by the way. This was a bad group. And I want to stress again that the sellers to Mr. Norris had no idea of any of this. And of course, neither did we. This all came up later. So he says, I'll get him down there, Wilkins said, of Norris. So he called Mr. Katsky and said, yeah, Leland's here. Well, there's a couple of guys standing down in the lobby who want to buy this bank. Send him down there. So pretty soon he showed up and he said, well, I'm sorry, fellas, I've already sold it to Mr. Blumenfeld. There's no way I can help you here. And we said, you're making a bad mistake. The money's right in that bag. And stock is in this bank. It was held as collateral for his loan at the Chatham Bank. And I said to him, you better talk to Mr. Wilkins. So he went and called Mr. Wilkins, and he must have given him a real earful, because he came back and said, well, maybe we could go along with this program. And before that afternoon was over, we had struck the deal. and acquired his stock, I think it was about 386 of the 500 shares. That was the 30th of November. The next morning, which I believe was a Saturday beside the point, December 1st, 1962, I came out to the bank and transferred all the certificates. And since that, those certificates were transferred to Arbor and myself and to our interests, and that situation pertains today. And thus ended the reign of Leland Norris. And I want to tell you that he had placed a lot of loans in Kansas City with people that we didn't even know if there were people on the ends of the notes. And my father-in-law and I got in the car and went out to Kansas City to see if we could drum up people with his name, you know. And we provided in the purchase agreement that the money that we owed for the stock would be paid to the bank to retire all those loans so that the bank wouldn't be... We heard, I don't know what Leland Norris got out of it in terms of cash. But at any rate, that ended the Leland Norris regime. So it's hard for me, you know, when I was a little kid, doing the things that I've already alluded to, my dad said to me one day, he says, Fred, someday you're going to wake up and be an old man. I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. But when I think that on December the 1st, 1962, I became president of the bank, and as I stand here today, that still pertains. That's 30 of the 80 years the bank's been in existence. That's 37.5%, you stock types will know, of the period of time the bank's been in existence. I've been the president. I just can't believe that. But that's the fact. So now I'm up to December 1st, 1962, and going up to today. And I mentioned, I think, to Eddie and Willard there just before the meeting started, really an appropriate day for this meeting because this was the day of our monthly meeting. And we have just completed a safety and soundness examination by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation representatives, and they were at our meeting today to tell us how wonderful it is. The bank will open in the morning. Everything is just great, with a couple of teeny exceptions. No, everything's fine. So without boring you with a bunch of numbers, I think I can give you a reasonably quick review of how the thing has grown since 1962, and we take no particular credit for this. It's just a lot of factors involved. Inflation is the primary one, I expect. But on December 31st, 1962, which was a month after we acquired the control of the bank, the total footings of the bank, which are its total assets, matched, of course, by its liabilities and capital accounts, were $1,410,000. In 1967, it reached $2 million. 1973, $3 million. 1975, $4 million. 76, $5 million. 77, $6 million. I just looked at the years in which it went up a million. 78, $7 million. 5. 81, $8 million. 1984, $10 million. 7. 85, $11 million. 3. 86, $12 million. 8. 88, $13 million. 1. 13, 1. 89 went up to 16, 5. Now that is explained tremendous increase of $3 million in 1 year was a result of that. We sold some 9-month certificates of deposit at 9%, which at that time was a very good rate, and we thought maybe we could raise $1 million. We wanted to see if we could buy money that quickly. We had to shut that thing down in a week. $3 million came in. I mean, funds really follow the rates. So we're at that point, we're up to $16 million, 1990, 17, 3, 91, 18, 5. 1992, at the end of the last year, was a real aberration, $21 million, 9. That's not a sound figure in that. On the last day of the year, a government entity came in and made a $3 million deposit, just threw us all off. We had to pay, I don't want to get into that. But as of the last of May this year, just a few days ago, 19,634, and that's an accurate figure. See, that's down from the 21. That $3 million deposit was in the bank for 3 days. So that was an aberration. Now, on the 28th of May of 1993, I'm about through with these numbers. I know they're boring for you. The total capital accounts of the bank, which include the capital, the surplus, the undivided profits, and the loan loss reserve, totaled $1,704,480. Now, if you divide that by the bank's assets, you get the so-called capital ratio, which is the very significant and closely watched figure, which is supposed to be and is an indicator of the soundness of the bank. The regulators are very particular about that, of course, wondering how the bank can respond out of its capital accounts if something goes wrong. This figure presently stands at 8.68. As a matter of fact, as of today, it was slightly over 9, which is, of course, an excellent figure. I think the regulators insist that it be 5 or above, something like that. But we're in good shape there. So you can appreciate that during a period of rapid growth in the deposits and the total assets of the bank, it's hard to keep that capital ratio up because that's the numerator of the fraction. And when that denominator, which is the total assets, is going up, you've got to keep plowing something back into the bank to keep that capital ratio up. Very difficult thing in a period of rapid growth. Not that we don't want people to deposit, but not $3 million for 3 days, please. Promise me, Eddie, you won't do that. Now,
if I win the lottery, I'm
well, we've had a lottery winner for a customer, and we're very pleased to have him, of course. But it doesn't. Well, I'm not going to say that. Now, since the December 1st, 1962, there have been some other significant things. And please, I'm getting near the end. You won't be bored much longer. On the 15th of February, 1979, we changed the name from Exchange State Bank of Brimfield, which was dear to my heart, to Brimfield Bank. And we did that primarily for purposes of identification. There's an Exchange National Bank in Chicago. There was always some confusion, and of course, Exchange State Bank doesn't identify. If one of our loan officers or our executive officer was talking to somebody and said, I'm from the Exchange State Bank, he didn't have any idea where that was. So we wanted to, being proud of Brimfield, we wanted to identify with it. So that change was made in 1979. Then in 1976, prior to that, we wanted to increase the capital of the bank from $50,000 to $100,000, and we did that. We sold 500 additional shares, and of course, every shareholder at the time had a preemptive right to acquire that number of shares that would permit that shareholder to have the same percentage of ownership in the bank they had before. And that was very well subscribed, and so the total number of shares outstanding as we speak is 1,000. Also during that period, as most of you are aware, we've had 2 remodelings of our physical facilities, plus the addition of 2 automatic teller machines, one located in Kickapoo, and recently have installed a drive-up teller facility. And we're trying to get that landscaping in shape for 2 reasons. One, so that we can have an open house as to that, and so that Henrietta won't be offended by the way things look at the back of the bank. But we're gonna make that look real nice. Now, if you'll permit me just a short commercial message at this time, let me say in all sincerity that the pole star of the present management of the bank has been, is, and will always be the safety and soundness of the institution. We feel the sober and substantial obligation of well serving the bank's customers, the community, and the bank's shareholders in that order. We believe that while the large money center banks are consolidating at a dizzying pace, just look what's happening in Peoria. The Jefferson Trust and Savings Bank is now Bank One out of Ohio. The Commercial Bank is now First of America out of Kalamazoo, Michigan. Even the First National, the solid rock of the Gibraltar, Commerce Bank of Kansas City. Nothing wrong with that. Great banks, all of them. I mean, they've got more petty cash than we've got footings. So I'm not about to criticize any of those banks, but it does kind of take away from the local flavor. And we believe that the future of community banking system nationwide is very bright, belong to the community bankers of Illinois. And we believe that community banks, for the most part, are conservatively and well-run, have the interests of their community at heart, and are close to their customers. We believe that this describes the Brimfield Bank, and we hope that its customers, many of whom are in this room, believe likewise. Well, I said, friends, not very exciting, but that brings us up to date. It's a banking business is a good bank, or a good business, and we appreciate the opportunity to engage in it in this community. And I'm very pleased that you asked me to appear here tonight to discuss the matter. Now, if there are, I'm always leery about asking. No, Al, you can't have a home. Al, you can have the limit on your signature. But is this on? Now, if any of you have any questions that I can't answer, I'll try.
How many independents are left, Fred?
I can't answer that.
Not many.
It's very few. And they just get swallowed up one after another. Now, of course, in Peoria, you got the South Side, and you got the Bartonville Bank, which is close by. Of course, the Bartonville Bank is owned by a man by the name of Backlund, who owns a lot of them, in Glassford and Dunlap and Quincy and Wyoming. But they're still a locally owned bank, and the Community Bank in Peoria is owned by Becker. And that's local ownership, I think.
Yeah.
So there are some, but when we went through all that business with the savings and loans and the
coat off, Fred, we didn't know they was going to turn the air conditioner off.
Well, that's not perspiration, eh? That's blood. No, when we went all through that business with the savings and loans during the early '80s. We all were concerned about the losses that were occurring, and then the news media turned on the banks. Well, I hope you've been reading the papers lately, because the response of our Congress to that was to, and there's nothing wrong with this, I don't think, but they increased the premiums that banks pay to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation horrendously. And that fund now is doing very well, and the number of banks that are failing is dropping by the numbers. So it'll be interesting to see how long it is before Congress dips into that to use it for some other purpose. But we're hopeful, of course, that the premium rates will decrease, as they should. But I think that I'm just positive that the community banks are the soundest of the entire group. One of which is our bank. Now, it doesn't mean that some bad things can't happen. They can, and you got to be vigilant all the time to try to prevent it, but I want to assure you that we are trying to do the best we can to operate this bank really in the community interest. I mean, it's like giving a party if nobody comes. Not much of a party. If we open the door of the bank, we don't have any customers. No use being there. Belongs to moi. Well, that bank's that clock, I don't know much about it. I just know that everybody that looks at it wants it. And it's been there a long time, right, Frank? That was there long before we took over in 1962. And Norris, that's one of the things he wanted. We had to almost tug with him. He wanted us to bonus him the clock for his good work when he left. So we couldn't do that. Let me tell you a funny story about that. I don't know whether it's out of school or not, but one of the things that was holding up the deal at the Chatham Bank with Mr. Norris was that at that time, I bet some of you remember this, he had acquired in the bank's name a Buick Roadmaster convertible. And he drove that thing all over the country, and not on bank business, because he didn't do any business with the bank. And he parked it wherever he wanted to, and all with a license plate on there, registered at the bank. We got every ticket he got. And I'm telling you, I've got in my file a stack of them that big, and he had a Sinclair credit card. Man, did he burn the gas. I got a letter from the postmaster of the city of Chicago saying, why is your car parked in a no parking zone on the post office property for 4 days? And I had to write him and say, I don't know. But the stumbling block on the the deal with Mr. Norris was he wanted to be bonused that car as a parting shot. And of course, I said to him, or Barbara said, or I did, I said, well, it's not our car. We can't give you a car we don't own. Well, he says, if you we complete this deal, you're going to own the controlling stock of the bank. I guess you can see to it that the bank bonuses it to me. I said, well, I don't know about that. Back to the phone to call Mr. Wilkins. I get him on the phone. How are you getting along? I said, well, we're getting close, but got a little problem here. Norris wants the car, wants to be bonused the car. And I about fainted. Mr. Wilkins said, well, what are you waiting for? Give the man the car for his good services and get him out of town. So the second thing I did on the December the 1st, after transferring the stock, was to send that title into Springfield and leave Norris, and he went away with a nice Buick convertible. But boy, that was a cheap price to get that cat out of town. I told Frank if he's if there's going to be a tape of this, I want one because I want to know what I said when I defend the slander action. But remember, truth is a defense. And nothing I have said concerning him, I don't want to disparage Mr. Norris, but his, as I said, he did not have the best interest of the bank at heart. And I think that had never been the case previously. I mean, nobody wants to kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
The tickets too?
Well, I mailed them to him. As a matter of fact, the very day I was looking at the copy of the letter as I sent to him at his Kansas City address, begging him to take care of them. I got mail from police departments all over the Midwest. And all I could do was tell him I don't know anything about it. Here's the guy's address. I don't think he lived there. I think it was a fake address. And I know it was his mother's address because he put a limit loan in her name in there. And she never responded to any mail, but that loan was paid off with our money when we bought the bank. Anything else? Been a great pleasure. I thank you very kindly.
Thank you.